Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
What I want people like you and me to realize in any kind of domain in our life is that you're in a society that tells you you're not enough. You're missing this, you're missing that. You don't have the right shoes. You don't have the right voice. You don't have the right face. Like, you don't speak the language the way that you need to or whatever. You need to code switch. You need to change all these things about yourself in order to fit in these spaces, or you're not going to be prepared for them. But actually, you've always been enough in any space that you were, more than enough, and that you can kind of make equally valid ways of being in any of these spaces.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we are delighted to bring you episode 115, Fear of Going Outside, a podcaster on Asian identity, mental health, and belonging. The month of May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. In some ways, it is an indictment that it's taken the awful events of the last few months to get this observance on our radar. But here we are, and here I am. As a way to help ground the conversation that you're about to hear, I would like to quote from a recent post from the Hogg Foundation blog. It was guest authored by Dr. Ravi Chandra, a psychiatrist and writer, who we invited to share his perspective on Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month and how it connects to our core concerns of mental health and building a more just, equitable world. And here I quote, "We are all on journeys of identity, belonging, and wellness, and our journeys are connected. We all need safety and strive for survival. We cannot allow times of tension, change, and distress to lead directly to loss of life. As I've written before, our identities are the ache of the world trying to have a new experience. I hope someday we can celebrate not just Asian American Heritage Month, but also Futures Month for the entire country, where we can envision a world with less suffering, more compassion, more wisdom, and more possibilities for us all." End quote. Now, that's quite a mandate. There's something about that phrase, though, "our identities are the ache of the world trying to have a new experience," that got my wheels turning. While I'm not absolutely sure that this is what Dr. Chandra meant, I think that it's nonetheless true that much of what causes us pain is that contradiction. We can't stay where we're at, but there's really no other place that we can call home. This idea has been grist for literature, art, philosophy, religion, but especially comedy. And so it is with great pride that, in addition to being able to talk about Asian American mental health, I am able to bring to you our first guest, who is a working comedian as well as a fellow podcaster. Austinite Ivy Lee, host and creator of the soon-to-be-launched Fear of Going Outside podcast, is here with us, and we're going to be having a conversation about inclusion, well-being, and all that good stuff, refracted through her own lens as someone who's endeavoring to make a name for herself as a creative person of color and second-generation Vietnamese-American. There's no way that my little intro could fully do Ivy justice, and so I thought I would intro her proper through a clip from an episode of Fear of Going Outside. This is all her.
It's so funny to me that the wilderness education business manages to sell itself as both personal growth for the private school set and punishment for juveniles. Like, literally, a judge can sentence kids to a wilderness boot camp. I can't imagine how messed up that would have made me, but at the wilderness rehab Adam worked at, he was the growth opportunity for some of the staff.
I would always be surprised because the ranch was out in the middle of nowhere, this really small town called Cameron. And I am such a different person to them. Like, I was like an alien, right? Like, here's small town conservative Texas. I show up in all my queerness. Mm-hmm. I would often be surprised by the connections I would have with people and who would get me. So out in that community, some people really liked me, got with me. And then other people were like, I'll never forget, after working with this person for 3 years, this person was in charge of our horses. And he took me to the side and said, you know, Adam, I don't know many homosexuals and I don't like many, but I like you.
So you're like, okay.
And I just said, you know, I don't know many rednecks, but I like you too. But he saw, right? Like, he saw me be consistent with the kids and treat them with respect. He saw my commitment to making sure the horses were taken care of. So he knew, like, I was a solid person. But I was the first openly queer person he knew. And so for him to, like, come forward and be like, I am changing my perspective, and that is due to our connection. That's really powerful.
That's what I love about people. There aren't any people out in the woods. What's so great about the great outdoors?
I mean, sometimes nature's pretty, but I feel like you can get that off of Instagram.
Yeah, pictures.
Just put like an oscillating fan in front of you and like a spritzer. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to be helping you go outdoors? Because I don't feel like I'm great at that right now.
I don't know how. So, you know, if you're talking to a therapist, like in a clinical setting.
Yes.
Right. Then I guess you do want a therapist who understands where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So maybe that's perfect. Maybe you're not dissuading me. You're just making me feel heard.
Yeah. I love it. That's a beautiful reframe. That's what we call it in my world.
I'm going to need all the tools I can get.
I feel good about Adam. He's giving me these warnings and laying out his bias up front. It's so hard to find culturally competent therapist, but it's important to have one when things like anxiety or depression do not present in the same way as it might for majority culture folks. Sometimes I have to spend half my own paid session educating the therapist on cultural difference because, for example, I grew up Buddhist. I got Buddhist problems, not church problems. I mean, thank God I don't have church problems, but Jesus Christ, it's hard to be Buddhist when you love meat and suffering, apparently. Anyway, Adam's not that therapist. He's doing the opposite of projecting, and he's gone outside. Seems like he came back in one fine piece. I'm ready for him to gay Esther Perel me.
All right then, Ivy, hello. How are you? I'm so glad that you could join us for this. I could have done a very dry episode on Asian American mental health.
You could, but that would have been a race crime.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. Yes, I think somewhere in our mission statement where I think we say something about not trying to commit race crimes.
Our mission. Yeah. Yes. It was workshopped. You get a lot of money.
So much strategic planning that went into. But yeah, we're glad to have you. And so thank you so much.
I'm glad to be here. Hey, is your stage name? Do you go by Ike or Imani on air?
I go by Ike on air.
Did I just out you? You're like,
The Imani Ike thing, it's complicated. It's complicated.
Is it like too complicated?
We go by Ike in general.
Okay.
But there's nothing taboo about calling me Imani in front of people.
Okay.
Including the podcast.
Okay.
Yes.
So whatever comes out, Ike or Imani, like that's fine when we get into it.
Yes. Okay. Alrighty. Tell our listeners about you. I mean, in my intro, I called you a podcaster. I know that you got all kinds of other things going on that have some degree of purchase on your identity. So give us a sense of your multiplicity and just the different worlds that you try to inhabit.
Okay. So, you know, when I like testify at city council or something, I just say, I'm just an Asian mom about town. That's really, but no, podcaster sounds much, much more important. So yeah, I am an Asian mom about town. But I am also a Vietnamese American writer, activist, and comedian here in Austin, Texas. As a storyteller, how I think you and I connected as a storyteller, I've been working on narrative change in the civil rights kind of arena for most of my life, trying to undo these stories that society kind of uses as an excuse to oppress people. But this year, like you mentioned, I'm kind of shifting to cultural change with the show I've got coming out from Spotify Studios on June 10th. It's called Fogo, Fear of Going Outside, which is a nature show by the most reluctant host ever, which I know that's not saying much because most shows are hosted by reckless white men.
You're right. Yeah. Identifying as a podcaster, it just, as more people start to do it, the more complicated that becomes, you know, because you now have other podcasters that you're trying not to be, or, you know, whatever bag you're in, trying not to be mistaken for somebody else that does it differently.
It's funny being, you know, my podcast on Spotify Studios, which is the same studio as the Obamas. And so I think by the commutative property, you know, I'm basically Michelle Obama. I'm basically an inspiration, but you could use the same logic and be like, I'm basically Joe Rogan. Oh God, somebody's going to use that audio clip against me.
Yeah. For those who don't know what we're talking about, just Google Joe Rogan. Google podcasting. Apparently, he has the most popular podcast anyone has ever done, which says a lot about the current state of the field, and how.
It says a lot about just humanity, the English speaking world.
Yeah. You
know, these mics didn't do anything to anybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, this episode, this conversation, is coming out at the tail end of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month.
I'm glad you could squeeze this in there at the end of the month.
Yes, and I'm telling you, in fact, you and I had a previous conversation where I said to you, these observances are kind of a mixed blessing. They give you an excuse to talk about something, to fill space on your editorial calendar, but it's.
But they give you an excuse to not talk about that
the rest
thing for
of the time.
11
right.
months of the year. Yeah.
Yeah. Let us talk about your month of May. What like personal moments or milestones have you had recently that relate to our two themes, AAPI month and mental health month, which is also happening in the month of May?
So I knew that this question was coming.
Yeah.
So I went onto my iPhone's app, which has really good artificial intelligence, actually, and I just searched, you know, Asian mental health, May 2021, to see if anything would come up. Nothing came up. I had to really dig deeper for this one. I'll say kind of my big mental health kick, and I'll tell you what's Asian about it, is I'm trying to get every single man in my life to go to therapy. And the Asian part about that is how I boss around younger men like I'm their big Asian sister. You know, I'm like, look at your life. Look at your choices. Have you eaten yet? You know, like, can I feed you? Or like, just that like very like big tough love, I guess, is how I'm going about it. And maybe it's not every man in my life, because I can't muster that level of love, I think, for everyone all the time, because I'm a very tired mom. But definitely what I call the important men in my life, which is the men who can make or break my life mission to break the cycle of intergenerational trauma. So anybody that is an important person in my kids' lives, so like their uncles, my beloved, like their friends' dads, like those kinds of people. That's really those men that I'm trying to get to go to therapy, because I'm looking around at these circumstances that, you know, when I was a kid, I've been working on this since I was a kid. Okay, as a kid growing up, I was like, oh, for my kids, like this and this, like this cannot be what they live with. And I've been putting in that work. I've been going to therapy. I've been, you know, like taking a lot of measures. Sometimes I trial and error, and then, you know, taking what works and building on that to make sure that I deal with my stuff instead of kind of putting it on my children. And now I need everyone, but it takes a village. So I need everyone in their lives to be doing that work in order to succeed. Like it's a team sport, breaking the cycle of intergenerational trauma. You know, I think a lot of people, they feel very alone in that. But I think culturally something I have to draw on is that sense of community that growing up, I know a lot of people, like white people, like in my life right now, who they don't want to ask for help. they won't even give, they find it very gauche, for example, to even give money as a gift at weddings, right? In my culture, it's not that way. But also just the way I grew up in America, in my neighborhoods, we kind of had a sense of course everything's rigged against you. So if you try to go at it alone, you're just a schmuck, right? Yeah. Like there is only kind of community, only collective power, only, you know, being on the same team will overcome these kinds of societal obstacles that we have. So I really need the men in my life to be a part of this team effort. But, and it's not that the women, I don't need the women. I do need the women. It's just the men, for some reason, need a lot more encouragement to go to therapy. I think they have this stigma like, well, only if something's wrong with me do I need to go to therapy. And as long as I'm not bleeding, nothing's wrong with me.
Yeah.
So like there, men are allowed to read like self-help books only if it relates to their productivity, I feel like. But they're allowed to read, like, they're allowed to learn and admire and grow from reading history books about great men, like capital G, great men. But they're dudes that like bombed Libya, you know, or Afghanistan or you know, where else, Yugoslavia, or like, I'm just like going through the presidents at this point. Like, I don't need to like name all these things, but I'm like, these are not like good dads. Like, they were not admiring them. They were like really great dads who raised children without trauma, you know? So I feel like there are all these people who, if they go to therapy, they don't think that there's anything wrong with them. But I think there's something wrong with all of us as we're trying to kind of break down white supremacist patriarchy. We were all traumatized by it, no matter who you are in this society. It formed you in some way. And whatever that is, like, you need to handle it so that you don't put it on my kids, because I've got a mission. I really think it can work. I really need it to work. I want nothing more than for our children to be able to thrive. Like, it was my parents' generation, like, they had to survive. My generation has to heal. Their generation is supposed to thrive. But if we don't heal, they're not going to get to do that, right? And they're going to have to pay interest on what we don't do.
For our 100th episode, which was produced just after the death of George Floyd and the ensuing protests over the summer, I made a point of having our guests, all of whom were African American, to talk about the fatigue that sometimes sets in when would-be allies want to check in on us only after something freaking terrible in the world has happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I heard a black guy just got his head sawed off. Are you okay? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Not to be overly morbid about it, but, you know, so, I mean, so much of what not just the last several months, but the last few years is like, it's just been this slow rolling snuff film. Mm-hmm. Without belaboring that point, is that something that you have ever felt or ever experienced?
Yeah.
And you can call, like I said, I before we started recording, there's no conversation that's worth having in which I'm not willing to implicate myself. And so you can even.
You've never done this to me. Yeah. It's that if you're experiencing it as a Black American at a certain level, like if you're getting 15 check-ins, you know, I'm getting probably 7 because I am the first minority friend for a lot of people. And I'm probably the only minority friend for a lot of people because just America, our lives are not as desegregated as I think people in other countries who see our TV shows and, you know, and see our music videos think that we are. So most people do not have really close, like their close circles of friends are, you know, not that diverse, I guess. That happens all the time. And I think for me, the exhausting part about it is that a lot of these people come and what they're looking for is absolution from their token minority friend that they're not racist. They're not really looking in to support you and check on you and help you process your grief in any way. They just want to know that they're not a bad person, which is just the wrong time to go and do that. Have you felt like you found, like, I mean, you talked to so many people about this. I'm sure you talked to a lot of academics on the show too. Is there kind of like a new, like, well-trodden, like, good way to deal with that?
I think It really depends. And sometimes you don't really know how solid your bond is with somebody until the bond has been tested in that particular way. You don't know who your true allies are until they have been ushered across that threshold into that kind of challenging conversation, that conversation about allyship. And so I like to think that, you know, that anyone who even thinks to check on me already has a level of fluency in the language of allyship and already is you know, somewhat in the habit of being non-defensive, you know, when their own privilege is brought into the discussion, that however it is that I would feel like responding, that they'd be cool with it, you know? That's a hard thing to just create a recipe for. It really does depend on the flexibility and but also the solidity of the relationship. I hope that somewhere in there was an answer to your question.
It reminds me, I had a really close friend once who I did feel I could kind of talk about these things with, and when they would check in on me, and you know, because it wasn't the only thing time that they reached out, like they were like a real friend, you know. But one time it came out that all of these conversations we've been having about race over the years of our friendship, she had never once gone and had a similar conversation with a white friend of hers.
Oh yeah. Hmm.
I mean I literally cried in front of her. I just, like, it broke my heart so bad. I didn't know what else to do. I don't know if I felt betrayed. Yeah, I think I did. I did feel kind of betrayed, I think, honestly, in that moment, you know, that we would have these, like, kind of conversations and that she was there, I guess, in the moment to kind of alleviate suffering, but then didn't go. But being somebody who was in a position to kind of spread that and bear the burden and and decrease the burden, not just bear the burden, but, like, and actively decrease the burden, that just wasn't an opportunity that she ever took.
Yeah. There is a group that is called Stop AAPI Hate. According to them, there have been over 4,000 documented incidents of verbal and physical hatred directed against Asian Americans since March of 2020. And what effect have recent events had on you? And this is not going on the assumption that anyone can just afford to dwell on this crap all the time. You know, sometimes it's more oblique. It kind of seeps into your view.
Are you checking in on me like we just talked about in the question before, Ike? We're gonna do it on here.
Does it? Hey.
Is that what we're doing now?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's like, that's when I call you Ike. Yeah. When you do that thing. Yeah. And I'm like, no. Like, quote switch. It's like, yeah. Look, the violence part, the number is shocking. Honestly, I am. When you said that's just since March, like, that did kind of stun me a little bit, to be honest. I didn't know that. I'm not sitting there poring over these kinds of statistics on a day-to-day basis. But the fact of violence against Asian people is really not new. Yeah. You know, my family came to America in the 80s, and my dad used to get jumped walking home from work all the time by people who felt that people who looked like him were taking their jobs. It was so common for him to get jumped that he told me a story, and the moral of this, about this happening, and the moral of the story was not racism is bad or whatever, right? The moral of the story was, for some reason, Americans won't fight with their legs. So when this happens to you, not if, when this happens to you, because it will one day, this is a fact of life in America, it's kind of his perspective, fight with your legs. That's how normal it is. That's the moral of the story. It's like, I don't know why they won't fight with their legs. I just got to this country. This is super confusing to me. But when this happens to you, Ivy, fight with your legs. I'm like, all right, Dad. And so for me, I identify with people of diaspora. any diaspora. It's not just specifically Asian diasporas that I identify with. The comedy that I write, the poetry that I write, the themes of the art that I do, I find that it's not just the universal and the unique, the universal and the individual. It's that there is a universal experience of diaspora, just like the different kinds of the grief, loss, joys, right, that you experience are very parallel because people in the diaspora are humans, right? Everybody in all these diasporas are human, and there is kind of a human experience to this displacement and movement. But specifically, the shooting in Georgia messed me up, Imani. And it messed me up for two big reasons. The first is that it was in Georgia. And I know American history. I know that we have always had a nativist streak and that, you know, that people who are perceived as foreigners are not wanted here. And I know that and I accept it. I've adapted to it. This is the only, I was born here. Right. I get it. And it's kind of a low hum. I don't even notice it most days. Like, that's how much we've probably maladapted to this environment. But of this place that doesn't want me here, I've only made two places home, and that's Texas and Georgia. The people kept calling it Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta. I lived in East Point. I lived in Dunwoody, Decatur. I also lived in Athens. I've lived and I've traveled all over Georgia. I lived there for over a decade. I'm getting old. I don't remember how many years I've lived there now, but well over 10 years. And I have driven through Cherokee County where the shooting started. And Cherokee County is so safe, let me tell you. I left my baby when he was a baby. I left him there on the way to a mountain in Blue Ridge, Georgia. I left him in the car seat in the car because he was sleeping at a grocery store. And a random old lady in the parking lot watched him for me while I ran in to get milk. And then when I came out, she lectured me about doing that, how I shouldn't do that. But the reason why I let her do it is because I know Cherokee County. I know what a safe place it is. And I bet that that's what these people who were working in that spa felt, that it was a safe place and that this could never happen to them there. So that is heartbreaking. But also afterwards, the way that even allies were coming out just wrecked me, because I know that I'm not part of the mainstream culture here, but I don't think I realized how little people understood about Asian people until the allyship came out. Like, I know that people can't pronounce Asian names, but people just kind of accepted the shooter's narrative of who these people were. And we're coming out like, you know, I stand in solidarity with sex workers. Well, I also stand in solidarity with sex workers. But there is, first of all, a very, I thought, well-known history of the sexualization of Asian women and fetishization of Asian women. That's like, where I was standing there, like, just because it's Asian women doing it doesn't make it sex work, right? First of all. And second of all, but these spas, like beauty, reflexology massage, you know, Korean like day spas, like all of these, like my, like a big chunk of my family's in the beauty business. One of the women who was killed was like getting a service, you know. These spas are a part of our culture, the way like Turkish baths or Roman baths or whatever, like these kind of more Western societies, you recognize that these baths and these spas are a part of their culture. It's a part of our culture too. And I'm like, they literally know nothing about us. That even allies were coming out and saying these things. And it just made me shocked, I guess. Like, it made me question so many of the relationships that I have with people, that I'm like, wow, does anybody really understand me? And if I make art that comes from my perspective, is anybody gonna get it? And then, like, what have I been doing? It just made you, just that level of ignorance about your culture, even though you share it freely. I'm like, wow, these people really don't know anything about us except for the food that we serve them.
Right. Okay. I've always loved the fear of going outside concept. I guess for me, what would be analogous is something like fear of gaming online. You know,
So you like camping, but you don't like gaming?
Well, I wouldn't say that I like camping. I actually do like gaming a lot, but only single player. I don't want to go online. I don't want to expose myself to, you know, this wider world of, because I feel like I need guides. I need to pre-select my posse. I need to pre-select my tribe before even venturing out into that beyond, I guess. And that seems like it's somewhat of a preoccupation of yours as well. At least what of your
planning
mm-hmm. and yeah. So you've gotten across to me that fear of going outside is about more than just camping. So I just what do you hope people will learn? And for our listeners, it's a brand new podcast that is set to launch this summer, I think. And so
June 10th.
What are you hoping that people will learn in the course of listening to the show?
Oh, man. You want me to spill the spoilers on the Hog Foundation podcast? Is that what you want?
No, absolutely not.
So it's a season one. For me to become a credible host of a nature show, I mean, obviously, I don't have much of a relationship with nature yet, but I am super obsessed with nature shows. So I know a lot about the genre, but not a lot about the topic. In season one, I try to figure out every step it takes to go camping, and then I literally go camping. And I think what people, our audience, I think is really bifurcated based on the Kickstarter thing that we did a few years ago and just the fans that kind of came out of that online, that half the people are super indoorsy and kind of excited to have their perspective represented in a nature show. But then the other half are people who are so outdoorsy that they think I'm playing a character who is absurd and hilarious. And I think their minds are going to be blown, but the show is not for them, you know, per se. Like, they're happy if they get something out of it, that's awesome. But it really is kind of about representation of other indoor people too, right? And what the questions that they want answered about what it's like to go outside. So I think what people are going to find is kind of an unpacking of what fear even comes from. And a lot of that is kind of about what we were talking about earlier, intergenerational trauma. That's why you want to be prepared. You have that feeling of whether you're going to go in. You don't love the idea of going into an unknown space full of random people that you don't know on online gaming. I do not like the idea of going to this place that has been painted to me as like wild and unpredictable and uncontrolled. I am somebody who has never taken clean water and electricity for granted. I never get tired of potable water just turning on at the turn of a switch, you know. And so I think what people are going to find is that they're not going to I think people know that there are people like me who don't love the idea of going outdoors. There are, I would say, nearly every famous comedian of color, definitely every super famous Black comedian, has a huge stand-up story about this terrible time that they went outdoors. And the thing about comedy, which Hannah Gadsby said in Nanette, is that they only tell you the first and the second part of the story, and then it kind of ends with a punchline. But they never tell you why it happened before or the part that happens after it. And kind of my perspective as a writer on that is because the difference between comedy and tragedy is just when you start the story. But a real human life is just constantly going through cycles of comedy and tragedy. And so it just depends on where you start the story. Like, did you start where you start the story and where you end the story determines the genre that you're in. So I am a comedian, but I accept Hannah Gadsby's challenge of not just stopping at that first and the second part in the punchline. And so you hear all these stories kind of in the zeitgeist. Trevor Noah has that really funny story about snakes. Kevin Hart has that really funny story about, I think he took everybody jet skiing. He's got jet skiing once and it went really badly. I mean, literally most comedians have a story like this. But over the course of 10 episodes, like all culminating in when I actually go camping, I don't stop at the punchline, right? There are all these people, you know, the premise of the joke is that camping is white people shit. But none of these comedians ever examine why and how, yeah. Right? And so this is season one, because I am a comedian and I need to tread new ground or break new ground. Like, I can't compete with Kevin Hart, okay, on his premise, beautifully told. So I take these, but I take them much further so that I can remake what a nature show that is completely from my perspective turns into a nature show unlike any nature show that we've ever seen before. And yeah. I hope that people kind of take away this new, not only a new view of thinking about the outdoors, but also a new view of people like me and kind of it's like I care very deeply about climate change because I don't want wars over water to displace more refugees like my parents. My parents were not displaced for that reason, but you know, that's inevitably what will happen if we don't get climate change under control. But at the same time, I don't even want to sit in my backyard. So so I have this like very different relationship to nature, and I want people to kind of have a sense. I think what people will come away with, people who are like me, are gonna realize what I want people like you and me to realize in any kind of domain in our life, is that you're in a society that tells you you're not enough, you're missing this, you're missing that, you don't have the right shoes, you don't have the right voice, you don't have the right face, like you don't, you know, you don't speak the language the way that you need to or whatever. You need to code switch, you need to change all these things about yourself in order to fit in these spaces, or you're not gonna be prepared for them. But actually, you've always been enough. Yeah. In any space that you were, more than enough, and that you can kind of make equally valid ways of being in any of these spaces.
Okay, yeah. So what you just spoke about, it's often things pertaining to the outdoors and nature. It's often sort of, you know, what people have in mind when they drop the word well-being in a lot of the different contexts where that word shows up. And one of the things that I think the Hogg Foundation really tries to get across is that there's no well-being without equity. There's no well-being in a world that remains as unequal as ours is.
Preach on it, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, environmentalism, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, making cities more livable, those with enough resources kind of already have that world already. Where we try to make a difference is in, you know, empowering other people to claim that for themselves. What everything that you're saying, I think very directly bears upon all the stuff that we've been saying about well-being and what meaningful well-being looks like in our book. So thank you for that. Thank you for giving me the chance to say all of that. During the intro, I shared a clip from episode 3 of Fear of Going Outside.
Oh, cool. It's like I'm on a talk show.
Yeah, episode 3. What exactly is going on there with your therapist, and what place does this moment from episode 3 have within the larger arc of your story?
So episode 3 is about mental preparedness, and I have a session. He's not actually my regular therapist, Adam Marr, in that episode. So in episode 3, I find a therapist who is willing to go on air, do a session on air, and we kind of talk through my fears because I want to check for mental preparedness to go on this camping quest that I have. In episode 2, I had some setbacks that made me question if I was mentally prepared. And so that's why then I go and try to find a therapist to figure that out. Eventually, later in the season, I also try to get medically cleared. I have to learn about plants and animals. I have to learn how to take a hike. I have to do all of these things to prepare myself to go camping. But as I'm sure people at the Hogg Foundation know full well, like when your mind's kind of not healthy for all of those things, and kind of the stuff on the outside is probably not going to work. So I'm talking to him about I think in that clip is one where he kind of shows me how he kind of is coming from the same place when it comes to nature, and that puts me super at ease because this is somebody that I'm just going to have this one session with, but I think people who are like me have a lot of anxiety when we talk to a therapist for the first time because we just don't know if we're going to have to spend the first few sessions just kind of teaching them the basics about, you know, your culture, your culture and your perspective. And, you know, that's like, I'm going to have to pay them to educate them about intersectionality, you know, and how much, like, you know, how safe are you? Like they want you to assume, just because they're therapists, that it's kind of a safe space to not have to code switch or be dishonest with yourself for the benefit of somebody listening. But that's not that is not a given benefit of the doubt that I give anybody, no matter what their profession is. I think you probably don't do that either, you know?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Beyond what we've discussed so far, what do you consider the biggest threats to your well-being as a creative person of color, and also the things that lift you up?
Specifically as a creative person of color, I would say there's just an age-old relationship between art and money that is just a tense dance. Yeah. Between these two. I think it's super obvious in the fashion industry where literally some of the richest people in the world are your customers. And then the people on the other side of the table are these like struggling artists who can barely afford the fabric.
Yeah.
Right. Who are gonna have to blow all their money in the fabric, not sure if they can pay themselves, right? Who have to be together in the space to do commerce. So artists of color have this other layer about identity to deal with when you need money to make your art. And there is just so much pressure, I think, there to you make your art more marketable. But what that means is to make it more palatable to white people and to make your art through the white gaze. And kind of that moral dilemma as an artist and a person of color can dig very deep, you know, kind of drill little holes in your mental wellness as you weigh these things. So I think it would be super helpful for people, whether they're consumers or gatekeepers or decision makers or funders, to be aware of that. Like, do I want them to change this art to this way because that makes me more comfortable? Or does it actually fulfill this artist's, you know, vision and put something out in the world that we've never seen before in a better, more efficient way or something like that, you know? And I think without seeing gatekeepers and people who are more established in the arts actively weighing those considerations, it's hard to kind of drop your guard down and not, I think it's not that, I hate to, it's there's gaslighting. Mm-hmm. Right. Like how do you know if you're not being gaslit, if you're not seeing other people have these conversations with themselves and having that introspection about how they interact with your art?
Yeah.
So that would be those are things that I think worry me as an artist of color.
Yeah.
What lifts me up? Other artists of color. That's why I'm in here. Yeah. Like being with other art people who are just boldly telling their stories, and then you see like, oh, they're still standing. Like you pay a price. Certainly, you pay a price for speaking up or not code switching. You know, you pay a price, but it's a bearable. You see other people, and not only is it a bearable price, but then they're all helping each other to share that burden. Then it does feel lighter when you feel like you can fly.
Okay. Well, this was great, Ivy. I really do appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today. So there are a dozen days left in AAPI month. So,
what are you going to do with them? What should I do with them?
I don't know.
Man, you're really throwing yourself under the bus on here on your own podcast.
Hey.
Dang.
Well.
I was feeling bad. I didn't try hard enough to get you in trouble. You know, if I'm a comedian, this very fancy new podcast, I should have tried harder. But man, you're doing it yourself.
Okay.
I'm off the hook.
Well, we've got a challenge for next time.
Okay.
All right. Ivy, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thanks. I hope you listen to the podcast. I hope you like it.
I will. I bet I will. All right.
All right. Talk to you later.
Sure. In July of last year, we were still deeply mired in the COVID-19 pandemic. And unlike now, there seemed to be no end in sight. It was time to have a conversation about the scapegoating of Asian people and how the pandemic brought deep xenophobic biases about Asian people to the forefront. To help us have that conversation, we brought on Dr. Eric Tang, Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and Director of the Center for Asian American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Here is some of what he had to say.
And what I've learned over time is two things. Number one, that no matter the differences between Asian Americans and, say, Blacks and Latinos, Asian Americans can never be white. You know, they can outwhite the white on all these metrics, you know, of like educational and, you know, say, career achievement. But they will never be white in the sense that whiteness is already predicated on othering Asians. And if I can put that in more precise terms, we have a history of tethering citizenship to whiteness. And Asians have been excluded from migration and citizenship for the majority of US history. It's only in the late 1960s that exclusions on Asian migration and citizenship were lifted. And so Asians are racialized historically as perpetual foreigners, even as the juridical restrictions on their citizenship have been lifted. And so there's a way that even the most successful Asians are racialized, cast outside of the notion of citizenship. And by that, I'm not talking about just the judicial definition of citizenship. People can get naturalized, they can have legal status, but they are never quite seen as American. Because to be American is tethered to whiteness, and that presupposes a kind of othering of Asians.
That was from episode 101, Asian American Identity in the Time of COVID. And we have included a link in the show description. And that does it for this episode. We're glad that you could join us. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Especially thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Special thanks to Anna Harris, Veronica Rodriguez, Julia Sufrin, and to the Hawk Foundation for all their support. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to be there for others, so it is that by being there for others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn. Thanks for joining us.